We are back on the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast on KCPW and KCPW.org. I'm your host, John Wildman. Joining me on this segment from my Bitch Talk team is Aaron Lim. And this segment is going to be about the documentary Mucho Mucho Amor, which screens in the U.S. documentary competition at Sundance. And we have with us the two filmmakers, Christina Constantini and Kareem Tapsch. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
Okay, let's start off. One of you, you guys, you go rock, paper, scissors, decide who does this, but tell us about the film.
Kareem, go.
Christina decided.
That'd be me. Not me.
So Mucho Mucho Amor is a documentary about Walter Mercado, who was this iconic television personality throughout Latin America and the United States, who every day at 5:45 in the afternoon came on TV with his horoscope predictions and this kind of amazing, beautiful message of love and peace and inspiration that he transmitted. We grew up with Walter. He was a daily presence in the home, and he was unlike anyone we had ever seen before.
Anyone had ever seen
before.
I was going to jump in. Anyone. Yes.
Yeah, we kind of describe him as a like Latino Oprah meets Mr. Rogers dressed as Liberace. We were obsessed with him. And so our film is kind of about his unlikely rise to fame and chronicles his sudden disappearance after decades on TV. He just disappeared overnight. So we found him.
Well, and you know, it was so fascinating about, I mean, he is such a larger than life, larger than film, larger than anything you can imagine character. And yet, at the same time, he's so personable and so open, you know, with the interviews that you guys do in the film, that I was just transfixed. Where did you start with this thing?
Well, thank you so much. Yeah. I mean, Kareem and I grew up with Walter, and so we knew the man that we saw on television every single day. But what we didn't expect was the man that we got when we started rolling our cameras, which is he is incredibly intelligent, incredibly well-read, but I think what surprised us most is he's hilarious. And so the film is, a lot of the film is kind of a back and forth between us and him of he has the most amazing one-liners. He is really flirtatious and fun. And so getting to know Walter over the past 2.5 years has been really an immense pleasure. And we fell in love also with the man that he really is. And he's kind. He is full of love. You know, his message was mucho, mucho amor. That was above all was he wanted people to approach the world and approach others with a lot of love. And he, deep down, is a very loving, loving man. And, you know, I think he taught us a lot. And I think that love comes across in our movie.
And I do want to touch upon the comedy, though, in the film. And I think it's Kareem that is asking him about the plastic surgery. And then you hear him again because you're saying, are you saying you don't have plastic surgery? And I love that he's like, well, I've had special arrangements.
That's right.
I was cracking up. So can you talk more about those comedic elements?
Yeah. He really is a natural comedian. You know, the thing that's funny is his background is so varied. He started as a dancer. Mm-hmm. He went on to do theater, and then he went on to telenovelas. So he kind of has all of these things that came together in this personality of the astrologer. But his sense of humor is so innate. He also knows, he's used it to his benefit in many ways, not just to endear himself, but also in how to evade a good question.
Yep.
And, you know, so Christina's an investigative journalist, so, you know, you're not going to get away without answering her question, but he's so cute that we use so much of it. And he's willing to talk about things, and
in his own way,
he gives it all his spin. I think the great thing about him is he's in on the joke.
Right.
You know, always. He's always was very serious about what he did and took it very serious and respected and adored his audience. But he was never above poking fun at himself and letting you in. You know, his jokes, his responses were always like a nudge and a wink to the camera. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, we talked to him about the plastic surgery and he was like, not major plastic surgery. Right? little arrangements. Special Botox like Nicole Kidman.
Yes.
And you know, how do you not love that answer?
I loved it.
He's answering you.
My other favorite moment is when we were pushing him to talk about his sexuality. He doesn't about his sexuality. And he doesn't like talking about it. He was born in 1932. It is, you know, he was way ahead of his time in many ways, but he still would not say, you know, like, I am attracted to men. He didn't want to have those conversations. And so we're pushing him. And Kareem says, well, Walter, you're not telling us that you're a virgin.
Yes.
And he takes a step back and he looks at us and then he gets this little flirtatious face and he goes, the only one in town.
Yeah, exactly.
And it also shut down. We were in tears and it shut down our line of questioning. And so he's a brilliant, he's highly media trained. He can direct the conversation in the way that he wants. But he was a real pleasure to work with. There was so much laughter behind the camera and in front of the camera. So yeah. I think the film is really a joyful film. It's a celebration of Walter. And we live in times where, you know, there's so much hatred. There's so much our politicians preach about divisions and the differences between religions and races. But for us, it feels like this is the time for Walter. Mm. We need Walter's message now more than ever. And we hope people fall in love with him and really and connect with that message and love. And we hope to spread his message more.
Well, and there's also, you know, the elements of, you know, in almost a cliche way, the signing over of his stuff and the contractual thing that, you know, that time that he went through, and yet he still comes out of that, you know, not you know, as far as what we're able to see, he comes out unscathed and he comes out, you know, not bitter and it's remarkable. Talk about. Again, you know, you grew up with him, so to speak. But talk about the surprises as you started working on the documentary. You started digging into his life. You know, what you know, for both of you, what were the elements where you go, "Oh, I would have never expected this."
You know, I think the fact that Walter just when he grew up and where he grew up mm-hmm. and who he was mm-hmm. confronted lots of challenges. I mean, you know, being someone who's so unlike anyone else around in that era, in Puerto Rico, in, you know, we're talking about the 40s and 50s, and he was always himself. He would not dwell on those things. He didn't really like talking about it because he would say, I don't focus on the negative. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't easy. We know it wasn't easy. We know that he grew up in a very kind of heteronormative, homophobic culture, machista, and, mm-hmm. you know, he still went through and said, this is who I am. Very important. Excuse me. Very important encouragement from his mother. It was really crucial early on, and he's in every room of his house at 88. There's a photo of his mother, and she absolutely gave him permission to be himself, and I think that was really crucial to it. And I think that his positive attitude that everything will always work out. Mm-hmm. He absolutely said that. He's like, you know, at one point I lost a TV show. It came to an end. And I didn't know what to do. And the next day, leaving the studio, I bumped into somebody who said, you should come work for us. And that was his, it was everything was going to, there was always a silver lining. Mm-hmm. And it was remarkable to see, even in the process of making the film, when his health was deteriorating, mm-hmm. he never lost hope. He never thought that he wasn't going to continue going on.
Yeah, I think for me that is one of the most surprising elements is he was such a professional. He would be in terrible pain. He would, you know, he was approaching the end of his life. We followed him for the last 2.5 years of his life. But he would pull himself together and he no matter what, he would fight through the pain and he would record or film with us. And even when he wasn't feeling well, he would film from bed. And you know, so some of the moments we have with him are those last hard moments. But the cameras gave him energy and they gave him hope. And so as soon as we turned them on, he was filled with this energy. You know, he says inside I'm 20, what does he say, 22?
Yeah.
And he was never, he never felt bad for himself. He always worked harder than anyone I've ever met. We submitted the film to the festival on November 1st and he passed away on November 2nd. And I think on some level, Walter knew that his job was done, that he had finished the movie.
And had he seen it?
He got to see some clips. We were with him 6 weeks before he passed away, and so we showed him about 15 minutes of the film, and he was very encouraged. Walter, you know, Walter was Walter's number one fan too, and he loved seeing what we were doing. He was so excited about the project. You know, it's certainly a great lament that he didn't get to see the finished film, but. His family was here for a premiere. His assistant and companion, Willie.
Willie,
I mean, everybody came out, and they're a little bit of Walter, and they brought a little bit of Walter with them. So it was really great.
Yeah. I've never met anyone who loves themselves so much, but also loves everybody else.
Yeah.
And that's a rare thing. Most people who love themselves are, you know, it's at the detriment of their love
for others. There's only so much room in your heart, right?
Yeah. His is expansive. He loves the universe.
And can you two quickly talk about the animation in the film? I really loved that. So if you want to touch upon that, it was beautiful.
The animator is this brilliant woman named Alexa Lim Haas, who she also is directing one of the shorts in the Omniboat screening.
In the Omniboat film. She's a Sundance, two or three times Sundance
alum. But she is incredibly talented, and all the animations are based on the tarot deck that Walter, that was Walter's favorite tarot deck called the Rider-Waite deck. And we studied it, and we realized that much of Walter's life was related to the tarot deck, you know, and or could have been predicted by the tarot deck. So we have chapter headings that are all from tarot, all of the animations that we use for things that happened in the past, whether it's, you know, he went through some health scares or his first moment of being magical, when he brings a bird back to life, that's all in the style of the tarot deck.
That's beautiful.
And we wanted to incorporate that kind of magic quality somehow. And I've known Alexis' work for a while, and I've always wanted to work with her. There's never been an opportunity. So as we talked this through, we're like, oh, Alexa would be great. And
Fangirls of Alexis.
Yeah, total fangirls.
Me too.
Well, we have to wrap up the segment, but I do want to ask both of you before we go, do either of you, did you get like one of the capes?
Yes, thank you, John. Or something
like that?
You know, the biggest thing we have is the memory of having worked on and spent the last couple of years with Walter. We don't have any capes, but we did get to wear the cape
to the
premiere, which is pretty amazing.
Okay.
Yeah, even Lin-Manuel couldn't keep his cape.
That's right.
So the capes stay in Puerto Rico. They live there. But he sent us records and movies, and we have things that he's.
Well, that had to have been a sweet red carpet shot then.
Oh my God.
So we'll never look that good again.
Well, again, the film is Mucho Mucho Amor, playing in the U.S. documentary competition at Sundance. We've been talking with Christina Constantini and Kareem Tapsch. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you guys so much. Thanks for having us. Yes.
You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast on KCPW and KCPW.org. I'm your host, John Wildman, and with me is one of my Bitch Talk teammates, Angela Tabora. And on this segment, we've got another one of our great slam dance films. We've got Jasper Maul, and we have the two co-directors, Bradford Thompson and Brett Whitcomb. Guys, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
All right, we like to start these off by letting our filmmakers introduce our audience to the film. So Bradford, Brett, which one of you gets the honors here?
Brad gets the honors.
All right. Oh,
thank you. appreciate
Jasper
that. Jasper Maul is a year in the life of a dying shopping mall. So we went and spent 9 months in a shopping mall in small town Alabama and just kind of witnessed what we think is going on probably in a lot of malls across the U.S., and that's just a slow decline. But while we were there, we found amazing characters and I think pulled something together that's special out of it.
Well, they are amazing characters, and you give us an opportunity to visit with a handful of the owners, and you know it's people are moving out, and also you know, our guy who pretty much runs the place, who is a fascinating character, but why are we doing this? Why did you guys land at Jasper Mall, and what was the inspiration to do it? Because I mean, I enjoyed the hell out of the movie, but I want to find out why you guys picked this mall.
Well, I think, you know, initially Brad found it by, he was out of town in Nashville or something, and he was driving through and just saw it and walked in. But we kind of have this, like, you know, a lot of our films are, you know, we do things that resonate from our childhood, like the Rockefeller Explosion and Glow. Those are things that are very, like, close to our hearts from when we were kids. And my mom used to drop me off at the mall when I was young, and I would stay all day because there was so much to do at the mall. Mm-hmm. And it was like, she could just be chill that I was there all day, and it was fine. But when Brad went to this mall, it just had that feeling that it hadn't been touched in 25 years. And it had this, like, really, like, nostalgic, you know, vibe to it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it really resonated with me as well, because my high school was down the street from a mall, and that mall has closed now. So it really resonated with me. All my friends from high school were like, the mall's closing. And I was trying to rush back to go one last time, because it's such a social scene, and it coincides with where we are as a society. You know, now we just buy things online, and we miss out on that connection. Even if you're not there with friends, you know, that person's working at Suncoast, or, you know, this guy's always at Ann's Pretzel.
Exactly.
And totally. You know, the gentleman playing dominoes, I mean, they're great. Mm-hmm. Just like the gossip chatty circle of them playing dominoes, and that social interaction and sense of community is just dying out. So thank you for reminding me.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's true. And that's why when we saw, like, Casey and Isidore, for example, we first saw them in their prom outfits, and they were eating at a restaurant in the mall and just hanging out and talking. We were like, that looks so cute and amazing.
I love them. Yes.
And so we just went up to him. We're like, this is so weird, but can we have your phone number? And then we tried to explain it, and that we're just two, you know, dudes, like, walking around the mall and with cameras and trying to, like, capture a vibe there for a year, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I was also, you know, I had this moment watching when we had the walkers, and when they first mentioned the walkers, of course, I'm a genre guy, so I'm immediately thinking zombies, which there's that Dawn of the Dead connection, and they go, oh no, they're walking around the thing, you know,
yeah,
and
literally,
and I thought, you know, I was going, that had, you know, I was going, man, that had to be the happiest of accidents, you know, to have that connection.
Absolutely, yeah. A big, that would always run through my mind, and my girlfriend April used to say, you have to put some kind of, like, throwback to Dawn of the Dead in there. We can never figure it out, but I'm glad maybe it just kind of worked out that way.
The other thing that cracked me up is that we get to see somebody applying for a job, and we get the walkthrough of, you know, of what the responsibilities are, and our security / custodian / keeper of all things in the mall is talking to the guy and talking about somebody basically doing something in the bathroom, but not in the place where they're supposed to, and the way he describes it is he says like they're being mean.
he says he just can't wrap his head around why that would happen, and he said he thinks maybe it's just meanness.
Just meanness. Yeah. Yeah.
You really hit the jackpot with him. Like, you had no idea, right, when you chose this mall, that the keeper was just this multifaceted character.
Yeah, no, well, for sure.
We did spend, you know, we spent a good 2 to 3 weeks at the mall before we started filming. And when we met Mike and hung out with him, and we just walked around with him sometimes without cameras before we started filming, and we were like, okay, I think this could work.
Yeah, because he's the through line. I mean, he brings us back, you know, because there's a lot of vignettes in the piece, and there are things that, you know, happen, and maybe you don't see those people again, but with Mike, it's always like he's the one who's guiding us. And yeah, once we found him and, yeah, we knew we had it.
Probably wouldn't work without him. Yeah.
No, absolutely. And the story of his life and his background, it parallels the life of this mall. That's like, mm-hmm. you know, one thing ends, but then the next thing comes. You know, that's just the nature of life. So it sort of parallels what's happening to the mall at the same time with his owning a zoo. I mean, where does that come from? It's incredible.
I know. It was a shock to us. We actually, I think that came out through, you know, I don't know if we learned that right away. So it was kind of like we were just there spending 10 hours at the mall. We'd get there in the morning and stay until we felt like, you know, we'd just hang out, we'd eat, and then we'd just kind of let things kind of come to us or see what would happen. Or if we saw some, we saw the Domino's people, and so we'd go up to them and, you know, try to convince them to let us put a boom over them. And, you know.
Well, I think what, you know, I think this, the, what struck me about the film, there's kind of a wonderful combination between that Frederick Weissman aspect of just planting a camera and let stuff happen in front of them, and the interviews that you guys do. And again, and I'm, you know, from a generation where I grew up in a little town in South Florida, and you had to drive an hour to the big Sarasota Square Mall, and for a kid, that was like the big thing, and everything was going on there. And now, of course, you know, as Angela said, you know, we get stuff online and we get stuff, and so that's, you know, we passed into this different time, and so there's a melancholy, and I would love for both of you to talk about that, about, you know, it wasn't just turning the cameras on and just letting life happen for 9 months. You guys are also capturing that transition, and, you know, and whether it be in the editing bay or, you know, or as you're capturing the footage, talk about what you were thinking along those lines.
Well, I think that we definitely felt it. I mean, like going in, it was like, I mean, we know where malls are in general. We know what's happening with them, and we have the real heavy nostalgia from our childhood that Brett mentioned. And so I think the idea that you know, this is a sad thing was there the whole time. But you know, there's so much attention paid to the nostalgia of a mall right now, and like the sort of neon aspects, and you see a lot of like, oh, here's eye candy of malls in the 80s, but there's no real glimpse inside of what's going on of malls today. And I think that was the idea, is that, you know, even though this is a sad thing and there's this sort of cloud of demise hanging over the, you know, most malls in the country, that we could go in and find some real beauty. And I think that's what we set out to do.
Yeah, and it's definitely fleeting, and we want to capture something that we feel won't be there forever. So it's like capturing it in a way that's observational, like you were talking about, that, you know, we're huge fans of, like, you know, older movies that, you know, like God's Country or Salesman or, you know, Warrendale, and, you know, movies that just go into a place and spend a lot of time and don't expect you're going to get anything. You kind of go in the mindset of, this might not work, but we're going to plant ourselves here because we kind of like being there anyway. So it's kind of like we're facilitating kind of our own need to want to like not lose that. So, you know, then you get a film out of it too, and we're like, great, you know? So.
All right. Well, again, the title of the film is Jasper Mall, screening at Slam Dance. We've been talking to the co-directors, Bradford Thompson and Brett Wickham. Guys, it's been great having you here.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for
Thank
having
you.
Us.
The Festival Daily Buzz is brought to you in partnership with Films Gone Wild. You can find more info at filmsgonewild.com.
You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast on KCPW and KCPW.org. My name is John Wildman. I'm your host. And on this segment, we're going to talk about The Reason I Jump, which plays in the World Cinema Documentary Competition at Sundance. We have our director, Jerry Rothwell, and David Mitchell, who's in the film as well. Welcome, guys.
Thank you very much.
All right. Let's start this off, as we always do on this segment, by having our filmmaker introduce our audience to the film. Tell us about the film, Jerry.
Sure. So The Reason I Jump is based on a book by a 12-year-old Japanese nonverbal autistic boy, which he wrote by pointing to letters on a letterboard. Naoki Higashi doesn't speak, but what the book does is kind of explain his experience and his kind of coming to understand himself, I guess. So the book consists of like 58 questions that people ask him about autism and his responses to it.
Okay, and how did this project come to you?
So the producers of the film have an autistic son and came across the book. And I think for them, the book was a real revelation about their understanding of their son, and really sort of shifted their sense of who he was. And they optioned the book, and there was kind of one constraint, which was that Naoki was very happy for us to make a film of his book, but didn't want to be in the film, which is kind of curveball from a directing point of view. So the film tries to immerse an audience in the lives of five non-speaking autistic people around the world, and uses the book as a kind of key to their world.
And David, you're part of this. Talk about your involvement with this film.
Well, I'm a novelist by trade. We also have an autistic son, and when he was three or four, things were at their most challenging and their bleakest. My wife, who's from Japan, obtained the book just via Amazon Japan, I think, and when it arrived, she started reading sections of it over the kitchen table, and it was a game changer for us. So many of the things we thought we knew about autism, this book just disproves and explodes. So many of the mysteries about our son, why he was banging his head on the kitchen floor when he got upset, why so many things, why eye contact was really hard for him, things we simply didn't know, the book explained. And so we translated it, initially illegally actually, just so that the people working with our son would know what the book has to tell them, because you can't really read that book and think the same thing about autism afterwards. And then, because I'm a novelist, my agent and editor just got to hear about it, and they asked if they could have a look, and within about a couple of weeks we had a book deal for my UK publisher and for Random House here in the States as well. And within about a year, it was in 35 different languages, and it sold, well, I've lost track of how many it sold, to be honest, but it's a lot.
Well, you know, I think something that's wonderful about the past few years, the education of autism and the dissection and the drilling down, so to speak, of literally the spectrum of autism. And when we do projects like this, there's a different responsibility. And Jack, I'd love for you to talk about that. About going into this and having that. You know, this is one of those things where that's on your shoulders to really lay this out in a way that a lot of people who've not been introduced to this are going to be digesting it for the first time.
Yeah, I mean, I think as a sort of non-autistic director, making a film which tries to take you kind of viscerally into the experience of particular autistic people, because obviously everyone's experience of autism is wildly different, it does feel quite a responsibility. But I had kind of fantastic guides. I think, I mean, Naoki himself, the book is so perceptive and clear about his sensory world, and how one of the biggest kind of myths I think we've that historically has been made about autism was to think of it as a learning disability or a cognitive impairment, where the world Naoki describes is one of kind of sensory overload, one in which it's very, he has a clear thought process, but it's very hard to communicate that thought process or to act with his body. So I guess those are the things we try to convey in the film.
I can't let Jerry gloss over the pains he's taken to involve autistic people in the making of the film. So we work very closely with the British Autistic Society to have autistic people as advisors throughout the production of the film, from the very early stages right to the final screening. And they've been invaluable. And it's sort of in the spirit of the book and the film to give these people who do not normally have a voice in society a voice in the making of a film about their voice.
Well, yeah, I'm so glad you said that, because we frequently talk, especially on this show, to narrative filmmakers about getting it right. You know, when they're showing various medical issues or whatever, getting the facts right, getting it right, so it doesn't become a Hollywood version of this sort of thing. But we don't talk about that about documentary, because we assume you're getting it right because, you're turning a camera on real people and you're having real experts talk. But there is a sense of getting it right just in the presentation of it, because, you know, we're seeing this, we're being introduced to this in the way that you're crafting it.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, yeah, documentaries are as much constructed as fictions, and that's true. The kind of onus on kind of accuracy and on a sort of truth to the experience of the people that you're portraying is crucial, I think. We had this group of 12 sort of autistic advisors who acted as our kind of checking in point, or who showed the film to at various stages. I was also really influenced by reading, there's a literature of non-speaking autistics at the moment, which is fascinating, writing about their experience. You know, there are a number of writers, Donna Williams, Tito Mukhopadhyay, Ida Kedar, Naoki Higashida himself, who are describing this experience. And I think they're not only fascinating for their content, but they're also brilliant pieces of writing, and I encourage people to go to them.
Well, we also talk on this show oftentimes about the editing process and to try to bring, pull back the curtain a little bit to the editing bay. And, you know, were there times where you were editing the film, where you were working on that, where you're like going, I need to add something else because I don't think this is properly explained, or I think I've weighted it too heavily toward this other aspect?
Yeah, I mean, I think as a filmmaking task, it was quite kind of interesting because the book is like a kind of how-to book. You know, it's 58 questions and answers. There's no story. There's no characters, although actually there is a voice through it. And the film isn't kind of driven by a narrative. So usually the choices you make in a documentary film are all about story and story beats and setups and payoffs and all of those kinds of things. In this film, I think it has its forward motion and its shape is sort of driven by this gradual sort of unpeeling of layers and of kind of the audience's progressive understanding. And so I guess it's how to sort of take people into that world, which we try and do in quite a sensory way. The film is mastered in 360 sound, so we're trying to create a sound environment which is very immersive.
I think autism has its own aesthetic. It has its own form of narrative arc that is different to a neurotypical narrative arc. We don't even know we have it, but we do. And what I think is really cool about the film is, as far as possible, it's tried to relay the autistic experience through its own aesthetics, not only through what is being said, but through what it actually is. I'm a fan. Of course, I'm biased, but it's a beautiful piece of work. And we can't change the facts of autism, but boy, we can change how we think about it. We can introduce new vocabulary to describe it. We can get the message over that, let's make the first assumption be not that it's a cognitive impairment, but a communicative one, which we mistake for a cognitive one because we, as neurotypicals, can't get our head around it. Narratives about everything are changing all the time, and film is just a great influencer in this shift, in this evolution. And this is a fine example.
Well, you know, it's funny because you actually beat me to the punch on my next question.
Sorry, John.
No, which is great, but it's that idea of, you know, anytime you're involved with a project, well, you're a cheerleader for the project. You can't help that, and you want to do well. But in this case, you have such ties within, within what this film is talking about, and you're so involved with that I was really anxious to hear what your thoughts were on, like, going, you know, the first time you saw it, like going, oh, I hope this really delivers on these things that I've been talking about. So.
I have a lot of skin in this game. And how can I make my life better for my son? Obviously, there's individual things I can do directly. I can give him positive experiences and hopefully kind of bestow a good storehouse of memories for him for when I'm not around. But more ambitious than that, I also want to be a part of changing the way that society thinks about autism. I want to, as the book does, explode a few of these pernicious myths that autistic kids prefer to spend their time on their own in the corner lining up their animals in order of size. I want to, as the book does, put into the garbage tip of history the idea that autistic people have no emotional intelligence. It simply isn't true. Ditto for the theory of mind, that autistic people don't get that other people have minds. It simply isn't true. And if you spend any time with an autistic person, you just know it. This isn't a dad wishing
what is not so was so for personal reasons. It simply isn't true. The book, what it is, disproves these myths, and that's all well and good, but not that many people read. And what's really exciting about a film is potentially the audience is global. And this will help my son. Just through educating well-meaning neurotypical people who want to know how to respond if someone is having a meltdown. They want to know what to do and what not to do, but they simply don't. And having these myths that they're labouring under makes it even harder. Yeah. That's a longer answer than I meant to give, John, but thank you for listening.
Well, listen, I think the two of you are going to have a lot of conversations ahead of you thanks to this film, and I think that there are going to be wonderful conversations that need to be had. Again, the film is The Reason I Jump. It's in the World Cinema Documentary Competition at Sundance. I've been talking to the director, Jerry Rothwell, and David Mitchell as well from the film. Thank you guys for being here.
Thank you, Joe.
You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast, and I'm your host, Angela Tabora, joined by cast and crew from Charm City Kings, which is part of the U.S. Dramatic Competition here at Sundance. We're so excited to talk about this film. We're going to have to talk fast because I got a lot of questions. But just to introduce who we have sitting here with us today, we have our producer, Caleb Pinkett, director, Angel Manuel Soto, and three of the really talented crew cast. We have Jahi Diallo Winston,
yes.
Kazai Curtis, and Mr. Danielle Hansley. So thank you so much for being here, guys.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
We're coming off the night of the screening, the world premiere, so I know you guys are really excited but also exhausted. So thank you for being here. We're going to start with Caleb. Can you tell us a little bit about Charm City Kings?
It's just a coming-of-age story of a young boy that wants to be accepted. He wants to get a bike. He wants a girl to like him. He wants to look cool. And it starts leading him down a path that he didn't expect. And then when his mother's hit with financial woes and he sees the weight of what life is and why his mom works the way that she does and goes to school, he decides he's going to try to be take on that responsibility. But the only way he can do it is by, I guess, nefarious means, so to speak.
To put it lightly, yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
And Angel, it was really emotional before the screening last night. You teared up, and you can feel your emotion, and it was really touching for the crowd to feel that. Can you talk about how you came on board with this project and why it was so important for you to make it?
Yeah, I mean, the script came to me through my agents, and I reacted very positively to it because I felt a connection between marginalized communities and Puerto Rico in itself, and I felt like the script and the story of it all really was able to express a reality that sometimes it's seen with a judgmental eye, and I felt like this was a good opportunity to approach it in from a place of empathy. Mm-hmm. So being able to tell a story like that. And you know, and being on the same page with the producers, with Caleb, with Clarence, I felt like it was our urgent need to create a story that, you know, caters to the reality of disenfranchised communities without falling into like misery porn and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So it was really fun.
Yeah, it was incredible. The energy in that room was incredible. I want to turn it over here to our talent. We'll start with Jahi. Let's talk about your character, Mouse, how you approached this character, because all three of your characters are very specific and very different. You all fulfill very different roles within the community. So let's talk about Jahi and or Mouse and what it was like feeling watching it for the first time with an audience.
Oh, it was exhilarating. Everyone was so open and accepting of the story that we were telling. They were very vocal, which I loved.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And I'm not spoiling, but at the end it was like universal, like just it was like a whole wave of just emotion, and that was great. Like that was just so great to be in the midst of that. I was sitting next to Chino Braxton, and we were looking around like, oh my god. He was like, yo,
powerful. Yeah,
it was very powerful. And so I mean, it was great. The energy was terrific. And you know, I was sort of nervous going in, you know, my heart was racing the whole time actually, because I was like, okay, that moment played. I was like, I probably should have did this, and you know what I'm saying? It's really hard to watch yourself. But yeah, overall it was great to watch the three of us and everyone on the screen just do their thing. So it was great.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Danielle?
Oh man, I don't even know what to say. Bro, it was crazy. Like, just because that was the first time we've ever seen it.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the first time I've ever seen it, because I was ever seen it. And I just didn't know what to say. Like, we all did so good.
Yes. Yeah. Well, really? Especially for you. I think after the Q&A, or during the Q&A, you were saying your character was the biggest stretch. You're yeah. nothing like Lamont. I don't know I'm if I believe like that. Maybe it. You guys can speak to that. But you say you're nothing like your character in the film.
Yeah, I'm nothing like him. I'm a dancer. I'm always goofy. Like, at the after party, they seen it. I'm always flipping, dancing, laughing. But Lamont, he's very hard-headed. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. He figures he has to do this to get, you know what I'm saying, respect, and he ain't about to back down from nobody. And oh no, my, he is a big question mark.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I think of him.
Yeah, cause I
yeah, just like the energy that day, it was insane. Playing Swear to God was a different thing for me, because I had to like be able to do the accent, and then I had to be able to do my comedic timing and work with everyone else. But yeah, just seeing it for the first time was amazing. Being there with everyone else was dope. We turned up at the after party.
Yeah, we turned up.
But you guys did.
Yes. So did you.
So did you.
So did you. So did you.
Yeah, I did.
Well, I'm 40, so I can do it. I'm an adult.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, just the experience of the first screening, it was so dope. I'm grateful. It was gratifying that everyone loved it, and yeah.
Yeah, and I can tell just from your reaction at the Q&A that you're not a far stretch from Swear to God.
Yeah, it's 50-50. Like, I had to learn how to, like, act like Swear to God, but then I had to, like, act like myself, too. Mm-hmm. So it was that cross line of those two.
Yeah. So. Yeah, well, one thing, a really beautiful message that comes across in this film when talking about disenfranchised communities is this idea of having a mentor, having somebody to look up to. But it doesn't always come in the form that you expect. You know, we have mm-hmm. these two different sides of this cop that's trying to take Mouse under his wing and make sure he stays on the straight and narrow. And then we have Blacks, who's played by Meek Mill, who still has the best of intentions, but maybe the results of that are different, right? So, Caleb, can you speak to the crafting of these mentors and how, you know, mentors can come in all different shapes and sizes?
Absolutely. People, you get teachers every day, and it just, they come from different sides. And one of the things that I wanted to do with them that I made sure was in the script was, it's two different fathers, and neither one of them are wrong, but they're different. And it's based off the model that I, there's a movie I love called The Bronx Tale, and the mafia figure Sonny, and then Robert De Niro's character, the father, who's a bus driver, and you got a kid in the middle who wants to be with the mafia. But the godfather is actually a better guy than what you would think. And it's like, it was such a beautiful dynamic that I was like, if we can mirror that in this movie, it will be great. That's why Meek, he's in the street and he was doing all that, but he's not that anymore. And he's trying to guide Mice away from it. I mean, Mouse away from it. Sorry, I said Mice. Look at that. still early. But that was the goal and the what I wanted to do with that. And Angel really was receptive to that and mm-hmm. agreed with it, and we were able to do it.
Right. And Angel, when speaking of directing this film, you know, I grew up watching films like Boys in the Hood, Menace to Society, mm-hmm. and loving these stories.
Shout out to my sister.
Yeah. So can you talk about directing this film sort of as an homage to films that have come before, but also making it your own?
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. We were talking during the whole pre-production part of the process about different films like that, like Boys in the Hood. What was this other one with the three white boys in the train?
Oh, Stand By Me. That was my other one.
Yes. Yeah. Like, yeah, I didn't think of that connection, but totally, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. No, it's true.
It's like the hood Stand By Me.
Yes.
Hood Stranger Things.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, we were watching a lot of those films, even like George Washington and all these other movies, just to like have a sense of how we can create a dynamic that's unique, mm-hmm. that doesn't fall too far from the tropes that work, you know?
Yeah.
We definitely love the homage aspect of it, and I love paying tribute to who tributes is due. But at the same time, the same thing happened with Sherman Payne, the writer. He got the script from Barry Jenkins, but he went into it, he worked it, and he made it his own. And I definitely wanted to take that approach when making this film. My visual language is very different from Singleton's or Umet or anybody like that. So definitely. I really wanted to make it my own, but at the same time, be able to pave the way for a new version of this genre.
Right.
If that makes any sense.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It is standalone, and it was so beautiful and so specific to Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
I want to turn to our crew, our cast here. Mm-hmm. How did you create this relationship with each other? Because I totally see the Stand By Me, like, to a T. It was such a beautiful relationship that you had with each other. What did you do leading up to that to create that authenticity?
Well, from right.
You know what happened? Every day after set, we would come to my room. We'll play the game for hours.
Yeah. And I think that, like, that's on real. Top of that, us auditioning, when we auditioned each other, we just mm-hmm. had, like, natural chemistry.
Yeah. Yeah.
From the moment from the chemistry read on, it was just, like, an instant connection. And then when we got together in Baltimore, like Dee Dee said, I mean, we would play, what, UFC in the hotel room?
And I would violate every time.
Not true. Here we go. Definitely an exaggeration.
On set.
In between him arguing with the Domino's pizza man downstairs, I would come home from work and Dee would be arguing with the pizza man in the lobby. It'd be like, Dee, what are you doing, bro?
I was walking home with my dinner.
That sounds like something Lamont would do, yeah. by yes. the way.
Yeah. He was in character.
He's a method actor.
He's staying in character.
He doesn't break the character.
Yeah. I'm not paying for something I asked for.
Yeah. Verbatim. Yeah, but it was great. It was, definitely.
Well, we're going to have to wrap soon, but we can't end this conversation without talking about Baltimore and paying homage to mm-hmm. 12 O'Clock Boys, which this is based on. Can you talk about making this authentically Baltimore and what needed to be done? Because that was really important to you, Caleb.
At 1,000%, besides my family being from there and having a personal connection, the 12 O'Clock Boys doc was more of a world thing that we got. We actually didn't, it's not based on that documentary because there was no real story for us to have there. We actually had to create an original idea, and using the backdrop of the dirt bike riders. You know, the idea of 12 O'Clock is the Willie sitting up at the, like, the hands on a clock, as Mouse says in the movie. But for as far as the city is concerned, I felt compelled to make sure we shot it in Baltimore. We hired real Baltimoreans into the film. We embraced the community because it's a forgotten city. It was a once great city that was a mecca for Black people, and now it's like, as you know, somebody in a high office said, it's a, you know, SIHIT hole. And I just feel like it was such a disrespect. So to bring something mm-hmm. to give the people a sense of pride in themselves, because mm-hmm. when somebody doesn't believe in themselves or think themselves of any value, the only thing you do is destroy everything around you. Mm-hmm. So I thought bringing something positive into the community, embracing the city, and bringing everybody together. I mean, I brought the street riders with the police mm-hmm. together. There was a moment where the first time that has ever happened, police are escorting the dirt bike riders to and from set. Like, hey, y'all back up. These are our boys. Yeah. But a week ago, they were chasing them and trying to arrest them. Had a warrant out for some of the riders. You know what I mean? And just the movie changed all of that. So I'm very proud to have done that for, you know, the Baltimore.
Yeah, and to be able to really respect the authenticity of the city and not try to make anything else than what it really is. One thing we really wanted to focus was on, you know, they are victims of their circumstances. This is not a movie about the circumstances. So if we, like, follow them and their struggle, it speaks for what we already know. So if we can excel the beauty of Baltimore, which is, like, you know, like the beautiful disaster type of thing, where the people are the ones that actually give life to the city. And I felt like keeping it that way, because I like that to be done with Puerto Rico at the same time. You know, we're not all gangsters. We don't all
dance salsa, even though I do.
Yes, you definitely
do. Yeah, we definitely saw that.
Like, we wanted to be really authentic to them, not to our perception of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you did an incredible job. We are so honored to have you guys here today. Again, we've been talking to the crew and cast from Charm City Kings, and watch this film. It's going to go far. Thank you so much.
And that's a wrap on today's edition of the Festival Daily Buzz on KCPW and KCPW.org. This show is made possible with partnerships with the Slam Dance Film Festival, GoTo Productions, and KCPW Radio. In-kind donations are provided by Pro Bar, Keto's Brewing, and The Market, Park City. Our audio producer is Charlene Godo. Social media help was provided by Shoshana Howard. And assisting us in production are Chris Gardner and Brian Silverman. Our executive producer is Lancia Wan. Thanks for listening.